Is your business model entrepreneurial or strategic? How would you characterize each approach? Why not select and combine the best of both?
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We are here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. At Economics for Business, we favor and actively promote the entrepreneurial approach to doing business. That's because we want to help businesses focus on creating new value and reaping the market rewards of doing so in the form of profitable growth. It's not the favored approach of business schools. They teach strategic management. As we'll learn today, that's an entirely different way of thinking. Consciously and deliberately, business schools teach non-entrepreneurial behaviors, such as cost management, low risk, bureaucratic control, standardization, building on strength rather than innovating and seizing new opportunities. Creating new value for customers is not on that list. Yet the great firms today, such as those in Silicon Valley, are imaginative and innovative and uncertainty tolerant. Are they somehow not strategic? No, that's not it. It's the business schools and their professors who have got things mixed up, not the highly successful modern businesses. Just another reason to get your knowledge and learning from the Economics for Business platform. To help us untangle this knot today is one professor who truly understands the common space between entrepreneurship and strategy, Professor Mohammed Kihani. He teaches both of those subjects at the Haskayne School of Business in Calgary, and he's also an expert in entrepreneurial technology. He operates the Entrepreneurial Tools website, which is a cornucopia of cutting-edge tools for business. He's a good friend of E4B, and he visited us in episode 104 to talk about generativity, one of his unique insights into the future of entrepreneurial technology. Professor Kihani, welcome back to the Economics for Business podcast.
Thank you, Hunter, for having me here again. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you here. We're going to talk about a recent paper of yours, one we're particularly interested in. It's called The Logic of Strategic Entrepreneurship. And we're going to highlight that new business logic that you propose and also some practical implications for people listening who are running businesses. We start at the point where you say the academic business literature has developed a dichotomy or a distinction between two logics, as you call them, fields of study. On the one hand, strategic management, and on the other, entrepreneurship. And we'll define those and dissect those, Professor. But give us some background about how this emerged, over what period of time. What were the influences that caused this dichotomy to come to your attention?
Well, as someone who did a PhD in strategic management, but was interested in entrepreneurship as the sub-discipline, basically, to study, I've always been fascinated with the relationship between strategic management and entrepreneurship. Within this management scholarship community, they are pretty much now considered to be distinct fields, although still, strategy is the more mature field with more history in business schools and more business schools who have a strategy department. But especially since Shane and Venkatraman in the early 2000s wrote an article that's now one of the most highly cited articles in entrepreneurship literature that basically argued that entrepreneurship should be its own field, separate from strategy. After that, entrepreneurship has gained a much higher standing as its own distinct field in terms of scholarship. Now, what has interested me about the relationship between strategy and entrepreneurship is, to some extent, the way that they have gained legitimacy as scholarly disciplines has depended on economic foundations. So what I mean is, to what extent can they base their theories and arguments on more mature, better modeled arguments from the field of economics, which is much more older and mature than both strategy and entrepreneurship in terms of scholarly disciplines. So both of these fields borrow from economics and base their arguments on economics in order to gain legitimacy as academic disciplines and generalizable theories. So for example, it's pretty well known that strategic management, before Michael Porter was able to import theories from economics into the field, sort of suffered from a lack of generalizable theory. And there was a lot of case study approach in strategic management teaching and research. But after Michael Porter sort of brought in the five forces framework by sort of inverting some of the findings from industrial organization economics and sort of looking at their implications for strategy, he was able to come up with generalizable theory, and his framework applied to so many different business situations. And people were suddenly impressed, and it created a lot of energy and excitement in the business world around suddenly having generalizable frameworks that could apply to different situations. And one of the reasons for that was that it was based in mathematical models from economics. And so since then, economics has formed a really deep foundation for strategy theory. I mean, yes, there are lots of different strands of strategy theory, lots of different scholars of strategy who are not necessarily basing their arguments or theories on economics. But you could argue that the most influential mainstream theories in strategy have been, in some shape or form, based in an underlying economic theory or economic models. And most of those have to do with taking the general equilibrium framework as a basis, and then figuring out what causes competitive imperfections in that framework that would lead to some firms having advantage over others. And that's basically the modus operandi of the strategy field, to use those imperfect equilibrium models to figure out what advantages some firms over others. Now, the entrepreneurship discipline has been a bit more varied and diverse, and it hasn't been as dominated by certain economic models as strategy. It's been more diverse. But for those people who have been interested to find some sort of economic underpinning for entrepreneurship, they were not able to find entrepreneurship in the models that strategy theory was using.
Well, in the neoclassical framework.
Yeah. Most of that framework, that sort of those equilibrium models, the imperfect equilibrium models, you couldn't really find a role for entrepreneurship in those models. And so what ended up happening was entrepreneurship scholars went looking for, well, what school of thought in economics does give a prominent role to entrepreneurs? And they found Austrian economics. And so Austrian economics became very popular with the entrepreneurship discipline and the scholars. However, the entrepreneurship community and discipline faced a unique situation, because the Austrian economics literature did not really provide mathematical models. And so it was a bit difficult to make that underlying theory, the economic theory of entrepreneurship, communicate with the economic theory of strategy, because they were just using different methodologies. Those guys were based on models. These guys were based on narrative arguments. And so for my PhD dissertation, one of my contributions was to actually try and make these two communicate at a mathematical level. I took a mathematical framework that was increasingly popular in the strategy field, cooperative game theory, and I added some temporal dynamics into it and sort of the processes of discovery and innovation into it with computer simulation. And everything that I added to those models was based on arguments from Austrian economics. I found them to be so well developed in the arguments in Austrian economics. They were so well developed and mature, and that you could basically model them. They just hadn't taken that extra step to model them mathematically. So I basically tried to do that, and basically, after I saw how these two theories can communicate with each other at a mathematical level, I started to better understand the relationship between entrepreneurship and strategy and the theories that we have in these two fields. And so when I look at literature like the strategic entrepreneurship literature that has been now trying for a few years to really make strategy and entrepreneurship talk to each other and sort of get some synergy or value from the way that strategy and entrepreneurship add value to each other, I look at that literature and I see, oh, they're still missing some things. Their arguments are still a little bit ambiguous in some places, because it's not based on a deeper understanding of the underlying mathematical models. And it's no surprise, because there hasn't been really a communication at the mathematical level between strategy and entrepreneurship. But because I was able to do that in my PhD dissertation in simulations, I thought I had some insight about how strategy and entrepreneurship link together, at least in terms of the underlying economic theories. And that's basically formed the basis for this paper. The paper itself doesn't have any math models in it, but right. It's based on insights from there.
Good. A brief diversion, but I've heard Professor Brian Arthur argue that economics has progressed from geometry, supply and demand curves, to algebra, the kind of mathematical modeling that you're talking about, and now is into computational economics, which is algorithmic. It can be modeled, it can be mathematicized, but it's algorithmic as opposed to mathematical, and that's where Austrian economics contributes something, because it is algorithmic.
Yes, I think many scholars in recent years have argued that with simulations, computational models, you can now start to really model Austrian economic arguments. And some people are doing that. There's this wonderful paper called "Was Hayek an Ace?" meaning right. Agent-based computational economist. Yeah. And there's lots of work that has been done in this, and my work falls in that category as well. I just think there's still not enough. There's still not enough of the Austrians have really embraced simulations, and because their underpinnings are still mathematical models. And there's been some resistance towards it. But yeah. I know many of the Austrians are in favor of starting to model their arguments with simulations.
Yep, that's an exciting time, I think. I personally look at the S-curve of adoption and think that Austrian economics is right at the beginning, even though we started it in 1871. It's early days yet. So computation will help us grow. Well, let's look at the definitions a little bit more, Professor, because we've got a lot of practical business owners and managers listening. What does strategic management say about business and strategy? What are the fundamentals of it? You mentioned Porter, but there's more to it than that, I think.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about practitioners who may be listening, I think in the world of practice, many people intuitively know all the arguments that I make in this paper. The arguments in my paper are maybe more useful for people who have been in some way influenced by the main theories of strategy and have been provided advice or business recommendations based on those theories, that they should, reading my paper, they might realize some of the blind spots in those theories that may have influenced their thinking. But if they just think in terms of regular, everyday business intuition, pretty much everything that I say in the paper, everything, all the arguments are pretty intuitive. So basically, the main argument I make about what strategy has been, as it's been a theory of structures and constraints. And that just comes from the way that it's been based on mathematical models. So for example, and mainly it's been models of competition, right? So for example, if you're a startup, and as many startups do these days, not really thinking about competitors, because what you're doing is really unique and not really, there's not that many other competitors. You're trying to create some sort of a new value proposition that hasn't been created before. You're not really worrying that much about competition. And so those theories of strategy may not be that relevant to you, because most of them are based on models of competition among players that provide similar value propositions, maybe with slightly different cost structures or other small differences, but pretty much they are considered competitors to each other. And strategy models the nature of that competition, the structure of that competition, and basically based on that, provides insights into why some companies may have advantages over others. I would say you probably intuitively know this, but as a practitioner, if you've ever based certain strategies on Porter's five forces or the resource-based view of the firm, you just have to take into account that these theories have blind spots, and those blind spots mostly have to do with things that are not covered in the underlying mathematical models, which are basically the dynamics of action over time, facing uncertainty. And those are the things that the entrepreneurship lens brings into the picture. On the other hand, if you have been not really influenced by strategy theory, haven't really thought about the structure of competition and what brings advantage, what sustains advantage, the questions that strategy theory has been thinking about. If you've just been a very sort of action-oriented entrepreneur, just learn as you go, just sort of getting into practice and sort of muddling through as an entrepreneur, you might find that there are things in strategy theory that help you make better decisions, because it provides you with some ways of thinking about structures of advantage that if you don't think about those things, you might end up making decisions that are not great business decisions. And I think most practitioner entrepreneurs do think strategically. They're not just, I mean, I say in the paper that these are ideal types when I think about entrepreneurial thinking without strategic thinking or strategic thinking mm-hmm. without entrepreneurial thinking. They are ideal types. No, I don't think anyone in practice is either one or the other. Everyone is somewhere in between, has some strategic thinking, has some entrepreneurial thinking. But I suppose the argument, like knowing that there are these two extremes, helps you figure out when you might be biased towards one or the other and when that might create some blind spots for you.
Yeah. Well, the other word, though, Professor, in strategic management is management. And I've seen it written, Vago and Lush are big on this point of view, that management, the concept of control and prediction, is it's a remnant of the industrial age, I think they said. And if you think like an entrepreneur, which is about value creation and adaptiveness and change, then the whole concept of management is not applicable. What's your point of view about that?
Yeah, I very much agree with the Vargo and Lush arguments. It's very much in line with my line of work. One thing I would say, though, is what they describe as management, I think in today's startup lingo, would probably be called operations. And it's very clearly distinct from strategy. So startup entrepreneurs today would think of strategy as something different from entrepreneurship. From operations. So I think strategy is basically about the big decisions and directions of the company and the business. And operations is about sustaining and managing an existing value-creating system. And I think the reason that in the past, a lot of the theories have been focused on management or operations is because the models basically start by having the value-creating systems already in place. In fact, multiple of them that are considered competitors to each other, and taking that as the starting point for what to do now, like what to do for strategic management or operations. And of course, if that's your starting point, then what you have to worry about is operations, because the value creating system is already there. For entrepreneurs, though, and I think many people are realizing that this is not just a problem for startups. The question is how to create that value creating system in the first place. How to create value in the first place. So, for example, if an entrepreneur has this idea for an app that creates Twitter banners for people's social media profile, just a very small feature, something that these days, the startup lingo for it is micro SaaS, micro software as a service tools. So if you're creating a micro SaaS like this, and there hasn't been any other tool that does this in the past, you're basically faced with this question of, am I creating any value at all? Like, is anybody going to pay for this and be happy with it? And can I have more customers? And that's a question that's a very fundamental question, but it precedes the models that strategy and strategic management theory has been based on. Those models start off with that question already having been answered. And so they're not very useful at that stage.
Pressing on that, Professor, is there indeed a logic of entrepreneurship, a theory of business management that is entrepreneurial? If we think of it as value creation, which is subjective, and we think of adaptiveness and change and all of those elements we've talked about, can you talk about a logic of entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I think the entrepreneurship literature and the underlying Austrian economics literature has given lots of mental tools to us about what entrepreneurial thinking is and what an entrepreneurial approach to business is. I think it's the emphasis on subjective value is important. Basically, the emphasis on just value in the first place, value, what creates value, and how a business system is even created, a system that we can call a firm or a business. And the idea that there's extensive uncertainty in many aspects of business, unpredictability, the idea that there is some value to action in the face of uncertainty when you can't predict, because once you take action, new information flows come your way and you're able to now make better decisions. You learn new things. And that's basically a very important mechanism that was not modeled in the equilibrium models of strategy. Just the value of taking action. There's now a literature around this that basically, even with mathematical models, shows that there's some value to taking action when there's uncertainty and you're not sure about what to do, just because of the learning value. So I think the entrepreneurship literature does provide us with a lot of insights that was absent in the strategy literature. And it's useful for entrepreneurs and startups, but I think it's also useful for larger firms and managers of larger firms that want to think more entrepreneurially and act more entrepreneurially.
A quick note. Economics for Business is a uniquely Austrian platform to help entrepreneurs build value-generating businesses at every stage of the entrepreneurial journey. We've now launched online with an outstanding database of entrepreneurial knowledge, tools to solve specific business problems, and a community exchange to share information and experiences. Check it out at econ4business.com. That's econ4business.com. Explore and let us know what works best for you in the feedback section. Now, back to our conversation.
So let's go there, Professor. I spend time on conference calls with consultants and big company managers, and one of the things they worry about is that the big company loses what we would call entrepreneurship. Innovation becomes slower. And part of it is because they're being defensive about their strategic advantage or their RBV, right? And that gets in the way of innovation and change. So how would big companies become more entrepreneurial in your thinking?
That's a great question. I think when a startup looks at those larger companies, to some extent, it's understandable because they have achieved already what the startups dream of achieving, which is a self-sustaining value-creating system. They have figured out a product or service or multiple products or services that create value for people, and it's recurring and it's happening over time. And it's been so much that the company has been able to grow and hire people and get larger. So every startup wants to get there. But it's understandable that once you get there, operations now become more complex. Managing day-to-day, just managing that recurring value-creating system becomes harder and takes more attention from the managers of the company. That it's just, it's very comfortable, or it's, there's an inclination or inertia that happens that where the managers sort of want to just manage that successful value creating system. But if you have a long-term perspective, you kind of know that things could change, disruptions could happen. Other companies may come in, other types of products may come in and decrease the value proposition that you're basically offering right now. And so thinking long term, even those larger companies need to think entrepreneurially about what to do next, how to innovate, what other products lines to get into, what to get out of. Those are very important strategic decisions. And I think there too, if you're just basing your decisions and your actions on theories of strategic management that don't have an entrepreneurial component to them, there's a dangerous blind spot you might be facing. For example, if a lot of the resource-based view recommendations that are given to large companies involve the idea of building on your strengths. And building on your strengths is a very important thing to consider, but you have to consider how it could lead to blind spots as well. Because first of all, building on your strengths is always the more comfortable thing to do, right? It's like building on what we're already good at. We don't have to learn new things that we're not good at. Great, let's do that. Managers are very inclined to build on their strengths because it's more comfortable. But if you think entrepreneurially, there are often things that you should do that are not really building on your strengths, but taking advantage of opportunities, building new strengths. Those entrepreneurial actions are often needed, but maybe in our blind spot if we are being given consulting and recommendations just based on the strategy theories that don't include an entrepreneurial component. Now, in my paper, I argue that ideally you do both. You are considerate about your existing strengths and weaknesses. You take them into account, but you don't let them fully determine what you do next. But you always take them into account so you know that what you do next, to what extent is it going to be easy? Is it going to be hard? How your competitors may be able to react or not react. So just an example of this. If you're facing like the early phases of the blockchain revolution, blockchain is a new technology has come up. Pretty much in the early phases, no company can say that we have an existing strength in blockchain because it's pretty much a new concept. Rarely anyone understands it. Anyone who wants to get into it is getting into it from scratch, basically. It's a pretty level playing field. Now, there might be some advantages that you have. Maybe you're the kind of company that has a lot of computer scientists or mathematicians or people who really understand easily understand the blockchain technology if they read it, if they learn about it. And so that is a strength in a way that you can build on, but it's a relatively generic strength that a lot of other companies may also have. So it's really not a huge competitive advantage, but you still know that relative to many other companies, maybe I have a lead if I try to get into blockchain early. But just the idea of getting into blockchain is an entrepreneurial action. It's pretty different from let's just build on our strengths, because whatever you're probably doing now is not based on blockchain because blockchain is so new. So if you just think about doing that better and just think about managerial and operational approach to moving your company forward, you're just not going to bother with blockchain, perhaps until it's too late, until there's too many people getting into it that you're thinking, oh, now we just like we have to, because the whole industry is moving that way.
Great example. One of the terms that we like, Professor, coming out of the complex adaptive systems literature is explore and exploit, which might be quite similar to your idea of combining strategic management and entrepreneurship. So the basic idea being always explore, keep exploring, explore blockchain in your example. When you get to a point of advantage, exploit it. That's when you apply management and strategy, but never stop exploring. So maybe you're on similar ground there.
I guess so. Yeah. And I think to a large extent, there is a pretty good match between the exploration exploitation dichotomy and the entrepreneurship strategy dichotomy. In many ways, not in every way, but in many ways. And I think a hallmark of that is that in the underlying mathematical models of strategy theory, there is pretty much no exploration. Exploration is not really a concept in those equilibrium models that the five forces framework or the resource-based framework is based on. That whole idea of exploration, of just doing things for the learning value, to open up options for things you may be able to do in the future, that's a very entrepreneurial way to think about things.
Yeah. One of the other literatures that we've paid some attention to, we had Dr. Sarah Sarasvathy on the podcast some time ago, and she talks about effectuation. And you might characterize that as having no strategy. It's you know, what's my knowledge? What's my network? What are my available resources? I suppose that's a bit strategic. But the bird in the hand theory, you know, go with what you've got, sounds not strategic. Or at least strategy is an important part of effectuation. Am I right? What do you think about that?
I think I would describe effectuation, I wouldn't say it's not having strategy. I would say it's having an entrepreneurial strategy.
Okay.
The reason that you might describe it as not having strategy is if you're thinking of strategy as the traditional imperfect equilibrium type of approach, where you kind of, it's based on a model where the value creation system is already there and you're just worried about competition and competitive advantage, or you're thinking of strategy in the perhaps even older meaning of the sense of a very planning-based approach. You set objectives and you just try to reach them, which is again based on that post-industrial sort of managerial, what the Vargo and Lush paper talks about as the managerial approach. Mm-hmm. But effectuation is basically saying, look, it's the entrepreneurship logic. There's a lot of uncertainty. You might not even be able to set like specific objectives because there's so many unknowns. But you know that you want to do something. You have certain resources that you suspect you can make something out of. There's certain trends that you think you might be able to take advantage of. It's like the fuzzy front end of creating value, creating systems. So I think effectuation is basically saying that it's the same thing about the value of taking action with what you have, even though you can't really predict perfectly or write on paper what's going to happen after you take this action. There's a lot of uncertainty involved. Mm-hmm. And I think the entrepreneurship literature has realized that and is trying to help people make decisions despite that uncertainty, because the strategy literature seems to just be very confused once that Knightian uncertainty idea is introduced, and you can't really, like, all the models just blow up. There's nothing you can do. Even some of that thinking has come into the entrepreneurship literature. I think that just nightly and uncertainty has become this big, dark monster that that just basically means you're paralyzed. You can't do anything. But I think theories like effectuation are basically saying, no, there is something you can do. Even if you don't know for sure what's going to happen, you know that you have some resources, you know that there are certain trends. You can take some action, and then you can learn from that action, and the uncertainty is slowly going to fade away in many aspects. There's always going to be some uncertainty, but by taking action, you resolve that in important ways.
Yeah. We don't think of nadir and uncertainty as paralyzing. We think of it as energizing, that don't worry about uncertainty. It's out there. So just act and learn.
Excellent. Yes, that's an argument that I make as well. I love to think about, and I think many people have made this argument, that nadir and uncertainty has a flip side. If, for example, the existing strategy theory is telling you that you have a disadvantage in a certain place, blockchain again can be an example. Suppose you don't have really the kind of expertise in-house that really could easily understand blockchain if you told them to go and learn about it. Suppose you don't have that. Just the fact that this is a new trend, that it's a pretty level playing field, means that you can probably get into it by hiring people or using the people that you have, even though they're not great at it. You can probably still be an early mover in that space just because it's so new and other people aren't in it yet. So I would say that entrepreneurial logic is basically saying, because of nadir and uncertainty, yes, it means that your current advantages are at danger. They could be disrupted. There's many things that could go wrong. But it also means that your current disadvantages aren't holding you back as much as they would if there wasn't nadir and uncertainty. And so there's huge opportunities that you could pursue.
Doesn't it give you another potential source of advantage, which is running the adaptive cycle or the learning cycle faster? Act, mm-hmm. learn, react, and go back again. And there's advantage in doing that faster than your competition.
Yeah. And I think thinking of that as a general capability to be more adaptive is pretty much what the dynamic capabilities literature and strategy has been saying. What some of the more action-based theories and strategy have been saying, that this is a very important capability to be able to adapt faster and go through this cycle faster. I think the lean startup literature has really emphasized that in the entrepreneurship world. It's not necessarily new, the logic, but I think at a mathematical level, it hasn't really been able to communicate. Like, the dynamic capabilities literature hasn't really been based in a mathematical model. And so it's been difficult. A lot of people actually just group it with the resource-based view as sort of saying that it makes similar arguments, because it's talking about capabilities that are owned by a firm that could be similar to resources. But basically what they are actually saying is a little bit different from what the underlying math models of resource-based theory argue. It's a more dynamic, action-oriented theory.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with resource-based theory. I always think, Professor, you can call anything a resource, and then you make that argument.
You can, and I think if you know the underlying economic models that resource-based theory is based on, you wouldn't call everything a resource. But because most of strategy theory isn't really playing with mathematical models, they take the ideas from them and then they just use them narratively in most strategy papers and arguments. Once it becomes narrative, then there's a lot more ambiguity and definitional issues and uncertainties. And I think that's where the problem has arisen for a resource-based view, where it's really no longer clear exactly what the boundaries of what a resource is or isn't are.
Yeah. So one last flip, Professor. I loved it in your paper that you said, hey, you entrepreneurs, you're all using strategic management when it's useful for you. And you talk about building moats, and that entrepreneurs talk about building moats. You had several types of them. So tell us about that.
I think entrepreneurs, like actual practitioners, are very much in tune with my arguments already. In a way, I'm sort of writing that for the scholarly audience and basically telling them, you know, a lot of you scholars have said, because of Knightian uncertainty and whatever, advantages are now at best just very temporary. And there isn't really any sort of sustainable competitive advantage or sources of sustainable competitive advantage when we're facing Knightian uncertainty. But I present to you what actual entrepreneurs are doing and how actual entrepreneurs are thinking, at least in the software world. They often talk about competitive moats. And that's basically referring to the strategic management idea of sustained competitive advantage. And another word we have for it is isolating mechanisms. The scholarly literature uses that term. But the actual entrepreneurs often use that term, competitive moats. And I think it's interesting because when you look at that, you realize that they are not as pessimistic as some of the management scholars who basically say that sustained advantage is no longer possible. The entrepreneurs know that there are certain competitive moats. And interestingly, some of the moats that they talk about are not well modeled in our mainstream strategy theories. So for example, in the software world, pretty much the number one moat that people talk about is network effects. And network effects is now, like, there's a well-known scholarly literature built around it, coming from the economics literature and the information systems literature, but it did not come out of the underlying equilibrium models that strategy theory was based on, like resource-based view or Porter's framework. The models that those were based on, they did not incorporate network effects. And one of the reasons is that network effects are a dynamic phenomenon. It's not based on a static model. It's a dynamic phenomenon where more users come in and join existing users, and the value proposition changes. And that dynamism itself has been difficult to model with the equilibrium models. So I think it's been a blind spot. Network effects have been a blind spot for strategy theory. Two-sided platforms with two-sided network effects have been a blind spot for strategy theory. It's really not easy to apply Porter's framework or the resource-based view to a lot of two-sided platform businesses. For example, Michael Porter's theory that competitive advantage is basically either differentiation or a cost advantage doesn't apply that easily to a lot of two-sided platforms. Like, I always say, compare Uber with taxis. Does Uber have a differentiation advantage or a cost advantage? Because it seems to me like it has both. And Michael Porter is basically saying that it's impossible to have both. So you're kind of seeing that the world of two-sided platforms and network effects is changing things. It's not the previous strategy theories are not as easily applicable to them.
Right. And your concept, which we talked about last time you were here, Professor, generativity, that's another example that you use in your paper as competitively advantaged if you can get it started. Is that
a good one? Yes, it's very difficult to have a generativity advantage. I'm very excited about the concept of generativity. I now have a book deal to write a book about it that I'm going to be working on for the next year. It's going to be called The Generativity Advantage, and it's basically going to apply ideas from generativity theory that has mostly so far been a theory of technology. And I'm going to apply it to and make it a theory of strategy, a theory of business. And basically, I think generativity advantage is a very huge competitive moat that is also outside of the purview of resource-based view and the existing strategy theories. Because again, it's a more dynamic mechanism. It's more related to the open innovation literature in a way, but the open innovation literature is talking about an organizational technique for the most part. It's talking about how organizations can leverage different management techniques and organizational tools to reach outside innovation, to take advantage of innovation of people outside the company, because there's just so many more people outside any one company and therefore so many potential good ideas. So if a company can successfully reach those outside innovations in a cost-effective way, it's a huge advantage. But the open innovation literature, in a way, has not appreciated how that open innovation can become automated through the product and its technology. And I think that's what generativity really is. Generativity is talking about technologies, and I think it can be applied to products that in within themselves have the features that get outsiders to innovate with them, and then benefits that those innovations benefit the company. So when you buy a cell phone, like a Google Pixel phone or an Apple iPhone, the phone itself is a very generative product, the smartphone. There's so many things you can do with it. And a lot of the things you can do with it, Apple or Google did not even imagine. They didn't have to know. They just created some tools and they gave it to you. And you, with those tools, can innovate. And often those innovations, you realize that, oh, so I can do this with the phone. Maybe I should create an app that other people can do the same thing and I'll make some money off of it. So they provide you with the tools to innovate and make money from your innovation, but they also make money from your innovation. I think both Apple and Google make something like 40% from app purchase or in-app purchase revenues. Which is huge, because they make 40% without having to have known anything. They didn't have to know the problem that you're solving. They didn't have to know the solution that you provided. They didn't have to make the solution. They didn't have to bear the risks of potentially failing. But they profit from that innovation. And they're not paying you a salary. They're not hiring you. They don't even have to know you exist. They don't even have to know where in the world you are, but they profit from your innovation. And that's a huge, huge competitive advantage that I think has not really been well explored in the strategy literature. And I begin to touch on it in this paper, but I'm in the process of working on an entire book project about this.
Good. We're going to have to wrap up for time, but that's a great place to leave things, Professor, on the very leading edge of where innovation is going and your theory of generativity. And hopefully it's in that new logic, the combination of strategy and entrepreneurship. So it all goes together.
Thank you. Yes, I think generativity is an example of how you can think entrepreneurially in terms of not just basing things on existing strengths, not just worrying about the structure of competition, but taking those things into account in making your strategic decisions.
Yeah, then you can build the app store, and that's sustainably advantageous.
Yeah, and that's an example. Like, I think Apple and Google are enjoying a pretty sustained competitive advantage.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, we look forward to the next time you can come and visit us with your book published, and you can tell us what the results of your work were.
Definitely, I'd be happy to. Let's touch base again a year from now and see where I am with the book.
Good. Well, you and I will talk again before that. But thank you very, very much, Professor, for today. It was brilliant and we learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit econforbusiness.com. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit hunterhastings.com.